Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's ambassador to the United States rejects Monday's military takeover.
I reject the military coup on October 26th, and that I shall be working with my colleagues in the diplomatic service and with the diaspora in the United States and around the world to see to it this coup is not accepted.
The UN Secretary General appeals for global action to deter what he calls the epidemic of coup d'etat. Former Liberian President Charles Taylor sues the Liberian government for his retirement benefits. Kenyan police deny accusations of involvement in dozens of killings, and Mali expels ECOWAS envoy.
It's a message to ECOWAS about the capacities of Mali to play a negative role in the transition process if ECOWAS is not ready to accept the proposal made by Mali.
And a victory for climate in Madagascar. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Despite the military takeover in Sudan on Monday, Noureddin Sati, Sudan's ambassador to the United States, remains in his post and vows to continue working with U.S. officials. In an interview with VOA's Nabil Biagio, Sati said that he rejects the military moves and is coordinating with Sudanese diplomats around the world to mount pressure on Sudan's military leaders to release Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and restore the civilian-led government.
I reject the military coup that was perpetrated on October 26th, and that I shall be working with my colleagues in the diplomatic service and with the diaspora around in the United States and around the world to see to it this coup is not accepted, and that the coup's intentions and results be reversed as soon as possible.
Since the coup on Monday, have you received any instructions from Sudan whether you should continue serving as Sudan ambassador to the U.S. or whether you have been relieved from your duties?
No, nothing. I have not received anything so far.
The government that appointed you has been toppled, the government of Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, and he's detained, he's imprisoned. This puts you in a weird and awkward position, does it not? What is your next move?
Well, my next move is to continue serving as ambassador of the Sudanese people and the ambassador of Sudan, the country, as long as it takes. I shall remain in position to defend the principle of the government that has been toppled illegally by the military. And I consider myself as being the ambassador of a country, not ambassador of a regime.
If General Burhan decides to fire you and appoint a new diplomatic mission, let's say in the U.S., will you defy the order and refuse to abandon your post?
I will, cross that bridge when I come to it. I cannot foretell what will be my reaction. It depends on the conditions that will prevail from now until that decision. And things are going to be much more complicated than that. In order for him to appoint a new diplomatic mission will be also an issue. And we know what happened in the past when the Bashir coup took place in Sudan. What happened? I'm the Paris ambassador, after 27 years. So I don't see, it's not going to be easy for this regime, this body, to appoint a new ambassador to the United States.
You're saying it's an issue of legitimacy?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned in your statement released this past hour that you have joined other diplomats here in New York, but also in other capitals, Paris, Brussels, to resist what is happening in Sudan. What are you doing exactly? Have you talked to U.S. officials?
I am talking regularly to U.S. officials. Today I spoke to staffers from Senate and officers from the State Department. And yesterday I spoke to Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department. I continue to engage, the U.S. administration at Congress and to explain the position. And I have to say that there is an overwhelming support to my position and that of my colleagues who have taken the same position. And we shall continue. I engage, of course, with the diaspora, and I had a meeting with the representatives of the diaspora in the United States yesterday. It was a very good meeting, and we agreed to work together. And I believe that my colleagues also in other embassies, like the one in Brussels, in Paris, in Geneva, in Beijing, in South Africa, and in New York, are doing the same thing.
That was Noureddin Sati, Sudan's ambassador to the United States. He was speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio in Washington, D.C. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has appealed to Security Council members to come together and make sure that there is effective deterrence to what he calls the epidemic of coup d'etats. The Secretary General condemned Monday's military takeover of power in Sudan and called for the immediate release of the Prime Minister and other officials that he says were unlawfully detained.
I once again strongly condemned the forceful military takeover of power in Sudan. And I urge, of course, all stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint, but the Prime Minister and other officials that were unlawfully detained must be released immediately. And it's true that Sudan has achieved important milestones. They cannot be reversed. And so it is essential that all transitional arrangements and institutions as defined in the constitutional document be reinstated. The civilian-military partnership is critical. It needs to be re-established at the level with which it was established. And I think the Sudanese people has shown very clearly their intense desire for reform and democracy. Now, we are seeing a multiplication of coup d'etats. The fact that we have strong geopolitical divides, the fact that the Security Council has lots of difficulties in taking strong measures, the impact of the problems of COVID and the difficulties that many countries face from the economic and social point of view. These three factors are creating an environment in which some military leaders feel that they have total impunity, they can do whatever they want because nothing will happen to them. And my appeal, obviously, is for especially the big powers to come together for the unity of the Security Council in order to make sure that there is effective deterrence in relation to this epidemic of coup d'etats.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking Tuesday in New York. A political analyst says this week's expulsion of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, representative to Mali is an indication that the transitional government in Mali is ready to play a negative role in the transition process if ECOWAS does not accept Mali's transition plan. Mali's Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop said Monday that the diplomat was being expelled for actions incompatible with his status. ECOWAS wants the transitional government to return Mali to democratic rule by February 27, 2022. West Africa analyst Ibrahima Kan of Senegal says Mali believes that elections in February are not possible.
I will say that Mali's decision to expel ECOWAS envoy, it's a message to ECOWAS about the capacities of Mali to also play a negative role in the transition process if ECOWAS is not really ready to accept the proposal made by Mali. The chairman of ECOWAS was in Mali. Apparently, he was very, very firm about the deadline for the transition. He wanted the election to be held in February, and the Malians are telling them that election is not our priority. Our priority is peace at the moment. So I think what we are going to see very soon between Mali and ECOWAS, it's a big fight. And I suspect that ECOWAS will soon start talking about economic sanction against Mali.
Some people say that the Malian authorities are trying to deflect from meeting the election timetable imposed by ECOWAS.
When you look at now the current situation, I think it's unrealistic to ask Mali to organize election by February. ECOWAS already knows that Mali's situation is becoming more and more complicated and that the government is not even in control of more than 20% of the territory. Who is going to organize the election? Where are they going to organize election? I think ECOWAS needs to really look at itself and see if the decision it is making realistic, and also the decision made by the head of state could not jeopardize all the efforts that are in place at the moment to save Mali as a state.
Is it likely that Guinea could copy this way of dealing with ECOWAS? Because Guinea, as you know, and Mali are facing elections timetable from ECOWAS.
Guineans are also watching what is happening at the moment between Mali and ECOWAS. And I think the slowness that the government is showing in Guinea-Conakry to nominate the government to take decision is also a kind of signal sent to ECOWAS by telling them, if you want to impose us a deadline without discussing with us a deadline, we will do what we can and we will do what we want. And when you look at the two situations, I think ECOWAS needs to really look at again the way it deals with this kind of situation in the region. And I hope that the next summit, which is also an opportunity for ECOWAS to revise the protocol on good governance, will be used to really think clearly a new approach on how to accompany states that are going into transition and how to make sure that the transition fully respects the spirit and the letter of the ECOWAS protocol on good governance.
Ibrahim Akan is a Senegalese political analyst. You're speaking with us from Dakar. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 27th. In Liberia, the chair emeritus of former President Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party says it is time for the Liberian Supreme Court to show its independence from the executive, no matter the consequences. This after former President Taylor this week sued the Liberian government in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS Community Court, over the non-payment of his pension benefits. Mr. Taylor said the Liberian government's failure amounts to the violation of his right to property guaranteed under the Constitution. Liberian government officials did not respond to our request for an interview, saying only that they were trying to get information about the matter. Chief Cyril Allen says the issue of Mr. Taylor's retirement benefits was approved by the lower court, but has been lingering in the Supreme Court.
Councillor Lavla Supu have filed an action that is gaining a lot of momentum here, to the extent that even the Chief Justice was approached morning to try to take a decision on that, because it's been lingering in the Supreme Court for a long time. I mean, that's out of the satisfaction that Councillor Supu had to proceed to file an action at the ECOWAS Court.
You said it's been lingering. I mean, when did former President Taylor make this request to the Liberian government? During We Are Government or during Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's government?
It was made during Ellen Johnson Sirleaf government. It's detailed as over 4 years ago since this matter had been dragging in the lower court. The thing went to the lower court. The lower court approved it and supported it. Then the petitioners went out to the Supreme Court. And for about 2 years, it's been lingering in there, dancing around. Maybe some of these leaders in the Supreme Court have been waiting to get blessing or nod from the national leadership. It shows that it's not an independent body. They must make independent decisions no matter what the consequences are. And when they fail to do these things, that's when the image of the country goes outside. And they should be queried for that.
The question is, some people say, why should the former president get pension? Because he has been convicted of crimes against humanity.
That's what they call crap. The fact of the conviction has nothing to do with Liberia, primarily. And secondly, he's served his term fully. And somebody who succeeded him that's been receiving, Moses Dash succeeded him. So the fact that it doesn't change the Constitution, that issue is immaterial to the decision. The Constitution of Liberia says so. That's why he should get his benefit. That's nothing to do with what somebody feels or has an opinion. It's not a matter of opinion, it's law.
So what's the likelihood that the Liberian government or that Mr. Taylor would get his pension? Because the Liberian government has yet to comply with the ruling of the ECOWAS court regarding the case of former Associate Justice Kabina Jane. Well, what's the likelihood that if the court does rule in his favor, that the Liberian government will comply with the ruling?
Two different situations, two different circumstances. This matter can be cleared from the ECOWAS court if and when the Supreme Court make a decision. If the Supreme Court make a determination on that, the government will comply and the executive branch will comply. But the executive branch cannot comply in the absence of a decision from the Supreme Court. That is where the issue is. And people will be naive if they do not admit that there's delay and dragging of feet with the legal, with the judicial branch of government. They must lift their heads up and try to do their work and stop waiting for support from the executive. They should be telling the executive what to do in the legal issues and not waiting for the executive to acquiesce with their decisions.
Chief Allen, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Chief Cyril Allen is the chair emeritus of former Liberian President Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The Missing Voices Coalition, consisting of 16 civil rights groups whose mission is to end disappearances and killings in Kenya, has met with mothers of victims and other survivors of police abuse in Nairobi. The coalition also launched They Were Us, a book on the subject. The coalition said it documented 119 police killings and 23 enforced disappearances between January and September 2021. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the police have denied the accusations.
48-year-old Lillian Jerry's son and two others were killed in May 2018. Allegedly by police in the Kiamaiko area of Nairobi. After the killing of my son, I wanted to commit suicide. She says, my other son asked me who will take care of him if I killed myself. I drank a lot. Jerry says, since I joined the women's network whose children were killed, it helped me heal and defend others. The mother of two said she reported the matter to the Independent Police Oversight Authority, or the IPOA, a body mandated to check on the work of the police. The IPOA advised Njeri to file the case with the other two victims in hopes of bolstering the investigation and getting convictions. However, Njeri says she's still looking for one of the mothers. In September, five officers were charged in Nairobi with murder over the death of a man killed in September 2018. The man was arrested for possessing illegal alcohol, and IPOA investigators concluded that he died of multiple injuries inflicted with blunt force. The court ordered the officers involved to be held until December 6th. Last month, the chairperson of IPOA, Anne Makori, told Kenyan editors the court is handling 98 cases of police abuses against the public. Since 2010, IPOA said there have been 8 police convictions. The Missing Voices Consortium, a group investigating unlawful killings, said 167 people were killed or disappeared in 2020. It says 157 of those deaths was a result of police killings. Kenya's police spokesman, Bruno Shioso, says these allegations are unfounded.
I think it's wrong to say that police have killed youth because we don't have that data, we don't have that information. These are just all allegations. But when you tell them to come forward and bring and proof or something tangible about it, nobody comes. So it's very hard for us to react to something, without any evidence. But we ask people, if they feel that police are complicit in any criminal undertaking, let them come forward, let them make a formal report to us, and then we pick it up from there. If they can't come to us, they can go to the oversight authorities.
Eileen Wanjiku works with Missing Voices, the organizer of Sunday's book launch, shining a light on the stories of police victims. She told VOA most families have yet to see justice for the deaths of their loved ones.
There's a really challenging problem, like just even getting it investigated, just getting it pushed to court is an issue. So the reason that many of these cases haven't even been investigated or pushed documented is because a lot of witnesses don't want to come forward because the protection for witnesses is lacking significantly. So you see cases where, witnesses are actually being killed for coming forward.
50-year-old Josephine Akoth is one of those featured in the 64-page book. Her son, Sylvester Onyango, disappeared in August 2015. The mother of six recalls that on the day he vanished, massive police operations were taking place in the Dandore area, an eastern suburb in Nairobi, and its surrounding where he worked as a public bus driver.
Sasa upande wangu, nimeshapita uchangamoto sana. Sasa mimi alikuwa naomba tu serikali.
Akoth says she has gone through a lot and she is requesting the government to help her search for her son and to help her know whether he is alive or dead. She says even if he has died, she would like to know where he was killed. At least she can collect the remains and bury them, she says. Last month, 16 mutilated bodies were retrieved in Garissa County from the River Tana, the longest river in the country. Hundreds of families went to the area in hopes of identifying the remains of missing loved ones. The families of the victims and the Missing Voices Coalition are calling for the implementation of the National Coroner Service Act of 2017, a law requiring independent professionals to investigate and prosecute unsolved cases. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Madagascar is known for its rich and diverse wildlife, but experts say forest degradation is a growing threat to both animals and humans. As Anne Onzuanku reports from Madagascar's Situngambarika Forest, there are success stories thanks to reforestation efforts met to reverse the effects of climate change.
Last year, this waterfall in the Situngambarika Forest disappeared for 6 months, as many waterways in the forest dried up. The state, with the help of the local population, launched a reforestation program. Anne Chambu is a farmer who contributes to the reforestation. He says the villagers use these water sources for their farms. He is proud to contribute to the reforestation of this forest, which is a source of life. Chambu adds their children will not have the same environmental problems as they do. The south of Madagascar is suffering a 4-year drought that the World Food Programme says is the worst in 40 years. The country has also lost nearly 40% of its natural forest. Advocates blame climate change but also the cutting of trees by the local populations. The Situngambarika Forest is a model of reforestation in the country. It has been reconstituted to more than 60% of its original size. 39,000 hectares have been restored out of a total area of 59,000 hectares. It is an important conservation area, protecting many endemic and threatened species.
Elle contribue surtout à l'atténuation du changement climatique au niveau mondial.
Vahinala Raharinirina, the environment minister, says the forest of Situngambarika contributes especially to the mitigation of climate change at the global level. It is a carbon sink at the global level, in the context where greenhouse gas emissions are increasingly important at the global level. Madagascar's contribute to this global objective. According to data drawn from the Global Carbon Project, Madagascar produced less than 0.01% of all the carbon dioxide generated in the world. Researchers say about 5% of the world's animals and plant species live on the island. Andri Rajuelina, Madagascar's president, calls for everyone to do their part.
Ce que nous demandons, c'est que les pays qui polluent le plus.
He says what he's asking is that the country that pollutes the most should help the country that pollutes the least, so that countries can really mitigate the impact of this climate change and help the population in this part of the Malagasy island. During the upcoming UN Climate Change Conference, participating states hope to reach an agreement to limit global warming and avert more crises like the drought that threatened Madagascar's forest land. Anne Zwanke for VOA News, Situngambarika, Madagascar.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.